And you're okay with the 371?
Okay. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. The first order of business that we're going to deal with today is the work session on possible bill introduction. Paul, what do you have for us?
Mr. Chair, there's this is the final day of bill introduction for the committee through the regular process. And you have three more LCs in front of you, LC 1790, LC 1206, and LC 3717.
Okay. Representative Eric Brewer, are you ready to make a motion on these? Or?
Yes, I will. I can I do it all at once, or
please,
must I do it individually?
Please, that would be great.
I move a process order, since I haven't witnessed this before. Is the motion typically to introduce these?
Introduce, yes.
I move that we introduce all the LCs as committee bills.
I'll restate your motion.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Eric Brewer moves to introduce, the committee introduces LC 1790, LC 1206, and LC 3717 as committee bills for this session. The committee, as always, voting to approve this a motion like this does not indicate support for a bill, opposition, or any other thoughts about it. Simply a mechanism to allow the legislature to consider the bills. And with that, is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the motion is approved, and these bills will be introduced. Thank you. Yes. Before we move on to our information meeting, has anyone gotten any news from Portland? No news is probably good news at this point. Okay. Well, that will close the work session on bill introduction and open our information meeting on school funding formula.
Oh.
Are you on that?
Actually, Day has got a panel, and we have Representative Kopp.
Ah, Representative Kopp, please.
Good morning, committee. Co-chair Barnhart, and I'm wishing well for co-chair Berger and her daughter and grandchild. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Betty Comp, and I serve House District 22. That includes Woodburn, Jervis, as well as North Salem. I served on the Revenue Committee my first session here in 2005, and I learned a lot. I learned that this I'd rather be sitting here than in your place, but what the biggest issue that I wanted to explore at that time was the state school funding formula, and what we received is what you will get this morning from our experts that are behind me is information about the funding formula and how it works. What I wanted to do is that share with you that in the past 6 years I've been working on this, that I've learned that our Oregon legislative funding formula is one of the most complex in our nation. The reason for this is that 20 years ago, our leaders worked hard to ensure that we had equity throughout our state, both urban and rural. That gave us the formula that you're going to be seeing today. However, it's my belief that that Oregon's education needs have changed dramatically since then. One of the most fundamental shifts behind the change in Oregon has been the passage of the federal No Child Left Behind. Many of the impacts are federal that we see today that are impacting our schools are the federal requirements, how to meet those, whether it's maintenance of effort, and a number of other things that you hear about on a regular basis. This not only altered the way that we deliver education to our students, but how we fund it as well. Our federal government will tell us they're giving us a lot more money. You might see that figure today. The average Mr. Reeder had shared with us recently in Ways and Means that it was common to have an average of 7 to 8% federal funding previously to No Child Left Behind, and now it's up to 18%. Well, that 18% comes with lots of strings, intense strings and demands that far exceeds most states' capacity. I mean, it's adding to their cost not saving us dollars. And I serve on the national committee for NCSL, and this is a commonality through our nation. It's not just Oregon. It's all of us as we deal with the federal mandates that continue to impact us deeply. I'm here to say, to share just one example, how the state school fund is currently allocated. I submit to the committee a chart depicting the impacts of the state school funding formula with the additional requirements of the school transportation formula. In this case, we have two formulas that impact the general fund allocations to all of our schools. The first column, titled ADM, which is average daily membership, represents the actual enrollment in each school district, while the second column, titled ADMW, reflects the effects of the weighted formula that gives many schools more funds than others. Some of the discrepancy in here between school districts is interesting and begs the question, as is it prudent for us as leaders of our state to reevaluate the true effectiveness and our goals of the funding formula? Is it equitable? I know this is challenging, but our students, teachers, and citizens deserve true understanding of where our dollars are going before we can define possible needed efficiencies and structural changes to our state in this current budget crisis. I'm going to rely on Mr. Reeder and others behind me to assist in possibly answering any of your questions. I have my own committee that is starting in 3 minutes, but I respectfully request that you support the concept of working with key members in this building to appoint a task force to review the outcomes of our current system and evaluate if any changes are needed or if it's fine as it is. That evaluation has not happened over the years, to my understanding, and there may well be some recommendations that would come from that task force that would help our schools weather this storm that they're in. Thank you. And I'm open for questions, but as you look at the material, seriously, the people behind me can answer them much better than I.
I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony and your long-term interest in this issue.
Well, it's key because I do deal with the expenditure side, but our districts can only do what they can do with what we give them through this formula. So your role is very critical in this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Beck.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, for the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. Sitting with me is Mike Wilfong from Education Department. With Steve Meyer retiring, we lost a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge. So I'm being aided by the experts at Education Department. And I have Mike so that he can answer difficult questions. K through $12 pay for teaching 562,000 students, operating 197 school districts, and operating 20 education service districts. Now, Representative Comp mentioned about the equity. And for that, we have to talk about equity between all school districts as a group and all ESDs as a group. But then we have to talk about equity among 197 school districts and among 20 ESDs. Now, this equity is your charge, your prerogative to define as legislators. School and ESD shares. Now, total dollars available is calculated this way. Now, state school fund We take off some of the special uses, and that becomes state school fund balance available. You add school and ESD local revenue, primarily property taxes. We're going to talk about the sources of local revenue a little bit later, but you add that school and ESD local revenue, then you come up with school and ESD allocation funds, so-called formula revenue. Next slide shows K through 12 school and ESD shares, what's been currently done. So the total resources available will be allocated between schools, school districts, and ESDs. So out of all the resources available, for distribution, of course, 95.25% will be distributed to school districts and the remainder to ESDs. So 95.25% of this formula money becomes K through 12 school share. You take, if you subtract school local revenue, then that becomes actually school district state school fund share. The similar calculation defines ESD school state fund share. This is a very rough description of K through 12 and ESD revenue. The state school fund is about two-thirds and the local revenue one-third. That's for 09-11 biennium. Now, the next presenter, Brian Reeder from Education Department, will have a lot more details on these statistics.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Gelser.
I just wondered if it would be possible to go back a slide.
Okay.
Please, I didn't say please, which is not very nice. Thank you for going back a slide, even though I didn't say please. So I just wanted to make the point and re-ask the question again of Mr. Warner that I've asked before. So look at that slide that shows our total state and local revenue of $8.8 billion spent on public schools. I just wondered if you would reiterate what we had talked about a couple of weeks ago in terms of Measure 5 and 50 and the impact on revenue available to schools. What would the additional amount available for our schools be had we not enacted 5 and Measure 50 over the course of this biennium that we're running out?
Representative Gelser, you can calculate that a number of ways, but I think the most obvious one based on this chart would be, well, what if those proportions were reversed, which is what basically what they were in 1991 when Measure 5 came into play. So you're looking at about $9 billion in state and local revenue. So if you were to switch another third over to local sources, that would be almost $3 billion for the biennium.
Thank you.
Again, what I'm doing at this point is to talk about general principles of distribution formula, and rich statistics and history will be discussed by Brian Reeder, and also he's going to touch on budget side too. How equalization formula works. Before we talk about that, let's talk about what the funding formula is not about. It's not about general cost reimbursement. It's not about revenue entitlement per student. It's not about funding adequacy or stability. It's not about student outcomes or achievement. And as far as district or school is concerned, it's not about quantity of inputs, although dollar figures are discussed. It's not about program quality or accountability. But it is about defining school district equity. It's about measuring the relative needs of districts for funding given certain student and district characteristics. And it's it reflects the finance issues and court decisions in the 1980s. So 91 legislature approved equalization formula and then implemented in 92 and 93. By the way, this funding formula is went through an evolutionary process, and it's been continually refined. Talk about distribution principles.
Did you plan to say any more about the history than what you have already, or not? Because if you have not, I wanted to go into it a little bit more now.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd like your help if you have some other information. I think it's important for the committee to remember that before 1990, each district was responsible essentially for its own funding, because most of the funds came from the local property tax. And some districts were very well funded because the local citizens either had lots of property compared to the number of students, or because even though they had an average amount of property, the locals taxpayers thought that spending money on education was a high priority, and they voted tax levies to pay for it. What that meant was that other districts, of course, closed in April because they couldn't, usually pretty small ones, because they simply couldn't fund the schools. The history for me is a little fuzzy about how the legislature got involved in funding K-12 education at all, but I know that it did because that property tax money was not enough, and those funds initially were distributed without reference to the local property tax, but rather based on a per capita basis or something of that sort, which meant that well-funded districts in terms of local property tax got roughly the same number of dollars per student from the state as poorly funded districts did. Of course, the lawsuits in the 80s that you referred to were not necessarily in Oregon and lots of other states that had to deal with federal lawsuits over the argument of maldistribution of funds. And I think there was a lawsuit, I think, in Vermont and a few other places where the federal courts essentially said, and some local state courts said, if you have a general scheme for funding schools, you have to equalize with some exceptions the funding that you're going to use. So when the legislature met in the early 90s to deal with Measure 5, one of the decisions that it made right up front, as I understand it, was that that there would be an equalization based on adding the property tax number to the state school fund number, the money from the income tax, and that with the adjustments that are made in the ADMW, it would be distributed on an equal basis across the state, which means that in some districts, half of the funds come from the property tax. In other districts, it's a small amount. In a few districts, they don't get any state money because the property tax funds exceed the total amount they would have received under the formula. I don't think that basic understanding that was adopted in the early 90s of the legislature has changed at all. As you pointed out, there have been refinements and changes in the way in which we make adjustments for characteristics of different students. Mm-hmm. But the basic idea that was adopted then hasn't changed, and I haven't heard anybody saying that there are lawsuits pending because based on this distribution issue, because this seems to be settled law at this point. Is that a reasonable summary of the rest of the piece? And I think it's important for the committee to understand how we got here, and then we can decide where we're going from here.
Mr. Chair, I cannot sum it up better, so I should not add any more.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Geltzer.
I think it's important to have that history, but the great thing about being a legislature is that nothing's ever written in stone, and
correct.
We can come back and look at very difficult issues. And I think there are few issues for our state that are more difficult to talk about changing than our state school funding formula. And there are a few words that inspire more controversy and passion than the word equity. When I served on a school board, we appointed a school district equity committee in which we were looking at the distribution of funds within our district between buildings. And that committee met for about a year and a half, and I don't know that we were ever able to land on a definition of what does equity mean. Is equity equal resource? Is equity equal access to opportunity? If it's equal access to opportunity, what is equal access to opportunity? Is it equal outcome? But I it's hard, very hard, to talk about this funding formula. But what we didn't anticipate, and what I don't think that the legislature really could have fully foreseen in the road that it went down, is that it was cutting its own legs off, not just for the districts that were not providing adequate education at that time, but for all districts across the state, including those that were that had both high property tax rates and large amounts of property in their district. I'm perhaps particularly sensitive to that because I live in one of those districts that's paying more than $4 per thousand on its property tax, receives a disproportionate share of money back from the state school fund, so it is a donor district to other districts, and has had to cut and lay off teachers and cut programs every single year since 1990, with the exception of the 2007-2008 school year. So for the kids in that district who have to pay ever more to participate in athletics and activities and don't necessarily have access to PE and music, the question of equity when they are paying in and supporting their schools and even operating a local operating levy on top of that is one that really begs a question. I think the other thing that begs the question is, if we're talking about equity in a funding formula, wouldn't we want a formula to be about outcomes and achievement and what it is that we're doing for kids? Really, that should be at the heart of any education discussion that we have. And I would just thank you for indulging me for a moment. I think I'm particularly sensitive to this week. We'll hear in the Education Committee tomorrow a bill that I've put forward that everybody hates, to be quite blunt, because it looks at, I think Representative Benz agrees with me, he's probably heard from folks in his district, but it looks at the school funding formula for districts that have fewer than 150 students in them, encouraging them as local communities to decide to either consolidate, or it gives them some flexibility to raise their own local property taxes to contribute equally to that value of having a school in a very small place for a very small number of kids. Maybe that's not the solution, but we have to be willing to have those conversations, because what we call an equity formula is not equitable for everybody right now. And the answer isn't to not have education in rural Oregon, but we can no longer continue to carry that on the backs of places like Oswego and Corvallis.
Hillsboro.
we need some equity for those kids, too.
And I'm hearing Beaverton and Eugene as well, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a fascinating discussion, and one of the things that I think needs to be thrown into the mix here as well is that during the course of the last 20 years or so, some of our prior urban areas have experienced a dramatic loss in the number of children that are living in those areas. And in particular, I'm thinking of close-in Portland, where you have schools with less than 50% of their capacity filled up. And while at the same time we had fewer and fewer children inside the denser areas of the city, in the outlying areas in the suburbs, we had a dramatic increase in the number of children. And when you layer that on top of the effect of ballot measure 5, which locked in our permanent rate in perpetuity, particularly in East County, in an area where we are very unlikely to support higher tax bases, we ended up with an influx of children without the infrastructure to handle it in terms of the number of schools, without the tax base to support it, without the equity funding from the state to help us with any capital improvements at all, with a voting public with no interest in raising their own taxes, even to build schools, or very little interest. And then at the same time, we are listening to the news reports from the Portland Public Schools refusing to close schools, refusing to consolidate schools, refusing to reduce their fixed cost and capital, even though it makes very little economic sense for them to hold on to those buildings. And then we're left to wonder why it is that the funding formula doesn't seem to be very equitable or fair. And I would suggest that if we're going to move forward on any type of a discussion like this, we absolutely have to address the changing demographics in the metro areas, because we're sinking a lot of money into buildings that are half full.
Thank you. You know, I do believe, just a quick comment on that, and then Representative Benz, I do believe that if the people who decide where to spend their time on mornings in committee rooms had heard the last couple of comments, they would be here instead of wherever it is they actually are. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can't help but look at the demographics of this group of folks sitting up here and notice that there's one rural person and another, everybody else isn't. The great thing about this debate, though, is it illustrates the opportunity that we are going to be presented. And the trick, I think, is to identify those things that can't be changed, such as the outcome of the court's decision, which imposes upon us certain things that indeed can't be changed by this legislature. And I think it's a really good starting point. The other one is, I agree with Representative Juan's remark about the demographics. And as I look across the eastern part of the state, and this, you've all heard this before, but I'm going to mention it again, there are certain income opportunities that no longer exist because of federal rules prohibiting certain activities on public land, most of which is in my district. And I would just say that each one of these issues comes into the equity discussion. One thing I just want to mention, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your indulgence in my wandering about here. It's that we have a state, and I have described it as a giant petri dish, and there are folks scattered all across it, many of them young, needing an education. And the state has to look at all of those as opportunities, each deserving an education. I think that's what the court was thinking when it reached its decision 20 years ago. So, as the one from the most rural of areas, I'll be looking forward to the debate, and I'm happy to participate in it.
Thank you. And may I just add a final comment, and then we'll probably go on unless someone else wants to jump in, that what got me involved in politics was the events in 1993 when the Eugene School District laid off 100 school teachers, not because the population of kids was down, but because Measure 5 was beginning to bite and the distribution formula didn't work for us. Like Corvallis, Eugene has essentially been cutting its staff since 1993. It may have been, except that year you mentioned, but I'm not sure. Now, part of that, of course, is because Eugene is one of those core areas like Portland where the school population is actually declining. The major part of it is because of the change in the way we fund education and the fact that Eugene is not allowed to support its own schools anymore and hasn't been since Measure 5 passed. That's what brought me to the legislature, and that's what led me to be the guy who favors increased revenue in the state as a solution. I mean, probably certainly not the only one, but a solution to the fact that we are seriously underfunding our schools and imperiling the future of our state and our nation because we're not adequately educating our kids. Now, with that, unless someone else wants to jump in, let's go back to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just absolutely fascinated by the discussion.
Well, we have a very small audience today, and that's their loss.
But for now, we're discussing equalization formula. state revenue and local revenue combined will be distributed as general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability grant, and facility grant. So the way we want to discuss, present this formula is backwards from facility grant to high cost to transportation and then general purpose grant last. Before we do that, the state school fund is funded by general fund, lottery, federal money, in this biennium by federal stimulus money and then some other sources. State school fund appropriation is also used for small high schools, $2.5 million a year, combined $5 million biennium. State special education, virtual school talented and gifted, speech language pathology, and then assessment, $0.55 million per year. That is taken out of ESD share. Now, the statute says expense shall be done in certain cases with specified amount, and certain expenses are or may be done. That there's a difference between shall and may. local revenue for formula, it includes, well, the huge chunk of it is property taxes. It also includes common school fund, county school fund, federal forest related revenue. The good news is in President Obama's budget, there is timber payment, but at a reduced rate for another year. The revenue from state manages forest land, and then revenue in lieu of property taxes. Now, local revenue estimate at this point is about a little over $3 billion, and again, property tax explains the most. Just to refresh your memory, state revenue and local revenue is distributed in four grants. First, equalization cost you see general purpose grant, transportation, high cost disability, and facility. entailing the cost factors. So general purpose grant is considers student cost weight and teacher experience adjustment. And of course, transportation cost, approved transportation cost is considered. And high cost disability students and also new facilities. So first, facility grant. It equals up to 8% of construction cost of new school buildings. It's prorated if biannual total exceeds $25 million. And as Mike will tell you that it is $25 million per biennial. So it's not like 12.5 a year. There'll be a little difference between the 2 years. Cannot be used for construction itself. Will be paid in the school year when the facility first used. High cost disability grant equals up to sum of eligible cost above $30,000 per student with disability.
Excuse me just a moment. On that last one, is that prorated in the event that it's oversubscribed, or is it first come, first serve?
About facility grant?
Yes.
For the record, Mike Wilfong, Department of Education, Co-Chair Barnhart. It is prorated, and it's not on a first-come, first-served basis. Essentially, what we do is we receive all the applications in the first year. We send out a payment of reimbursement we think will likely be for the overall biennium, and then we prorate that based on a biennial basis, taking into account the full $25 million.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Arbrewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the facilities is something that I want to hone in on a long-term planning basis here, because our delivery model of education services is changing, where we will not be intent on bricks and mortar in the future. And Portland City is showing, is demonstrating to us too, that they have, a lot of deferred maintenance on their buildings that are not being fully utilized. So that, you know, it's excess capital costs, and so. As if we do open up the formula at some point for greater discussion, the facility grant, I'd like to look at filtering it through as the long-term delivery of education services here.
Thank you. Moving on to high-cost disability grant at and it's the grant is limited to $18 million per year, and costs are prorated if total becomes above $18 million. And it was passed in 2003 for 2 years at $25,000, but was made permanent in 2005 at $30,000. And cost, the statute says, may include ESD cost per student.
Members of the committee, currently we tend to see roughly a little over 1,000 students that qualify that exceed the 30,000 threshold. And again, those we have a list of those will cost that are identified. Primarily, those are general fund expenditures by the district for special education services. The intent of the high cost disability grant, of course, is in where we have outliers. For instance, where we have a student that has upwards of $200,000 in the cost, it helps those districts. The prorate, and again, we've exceeded it every year that I've administered this grant. Typically, we see right around $23 million in eligible costs, and so the reimbursement rate is roughly between 75 to 65% on the dollar. And again, it's to try to help offset some of those costs where we have, extreme cases of $200,000, but on average, it tends to be, the costs tend to be about between, $40,000, $45,000, for the majority of the 1,200 students that qualify.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the students who are those high costs, do they tend to be residential students that are placed in residential treatment programs?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser. Not so much as placed in residential care. We have a separate funding mechanism for residential care for long-term care and treatment right. Hospitals. The high-cost disability is primarily for expenses related to the school district. Long-term care and treatment, again, that's a separate carve-out that we distribute funds for.
Great. I think what I was getting more, I know in our district we claimed a high-cost disability grant for a student that did not go through long-term care and treatment because it was not necessarily considered a mental health placement. I guess just one other point that I wanted to make that's interesting to me about the high-cost disability grant. Last session, we made the choice to close the Oregon School for the Blind, where we were spending in excess of $150,000 per student per year. What is interesting about that has been the lack of claim on high-cost disability grant from those students and the very low claim against the Blind and Visually Impaired Fund, which we set up. Including, I think we now have 3 or 4 students that are now enrolled at the Washington State School for the Blind, and they are serving those students, including residential, for less than half what the cost was to serve them here in Oregon. And the rest of the students have been absorbed into their districts, with none of those districts claiming high-cost disability funds.
Bravo. That sounds like a successful transition.
I believe so,
yeah,
yes, Mr.
Sure Chair. Sure does. One comment that I was going to make on this one is that this is the sort of wrinkle in the fund that could make a huge difference to a small district that suddenly finds itself dealing with a very high cost student. If you think about the way the distribution works, very low numbers. Distribution works. A large district like Portland or Beaverton is going to have some of these students every year. A small district, a population small district, will have one once in a while. And of course, without a fund like this, it could be utterly devastating to the local budget. And I think that was the reason for setting it up in the first place.
About transportation cost, Representative Comp briefly touched on in the beginning of today's committee meeting. Transportation grant equals 70 to 90% of approved transportation cost. Transportation grant as a percent of approved cost, districts are ranked by cost per student from high to low, the highest 10%. Districts will get 90% of approved cost as transportation grant, and next 10%, 80%, and the remaining 80% will get their cost in, reimbursed at 70% rate. Approved transportation cost, listed here. And for the sake of saving time, let's move on to transportation costs. In 2010-11 school year, about a little over 70% of approved transportation costs will be expected to be reimbursed. Just a tiny bit over 70%. Now, general purpose grant. So we talked about facility, high cost, and then transportation grant. Now, this general purpose grant equals weighted students, which will be discussed shortly. And then there is 4,500 target adjusted by teacher experience, and that the whole money will be balanced to available funds. So you take a facility, high cost, and transportation grant. The available funds will be used for general purpose grant. Again, in a formula, but more succinctly, we can say this ADMW extended, which will be discussed in the next slide, multiplied by 4,500, adjusted by teacher experience, and made to exhaust all the available funds remaining. By the way, if balance ratio is 1, then this much will be granted as general purpose grant. And obviously, in good times, balance ratio would rise, and in recessions, this ratio would decline. There were times when this balance ratio was below 1, and I think Brian will touch on that area too. Formula students now. Weight to how do we weight students? Well, to be used for general purpose grant, we have 3 ADM, ADMW, and extended ADMW. ADM, of course, is average daily membership. With kindergarten at half weight, of course, there is a bill to change that to full weight in starting from 2015. ADMW is adjusted by student cost weights. You had we're going to talk about this student weights in the next slide. Extended ADMW is the higher of the current or the prior ADMW. So this extended ADMW will be used for general purpose grant. Student cost weight. All the students have weight of 1 first in the first place, except the kindergarten students. Students on IEP has additional weight of 1. Students poverty.
So we start with 1.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And then we add these on.
Yes, these are additional weights.
Yeah.
ESL students get another half weight. Pregnant and parenting students get additional 1. Unit weight, but the maximum additional weight allowed is limited to 2. Now, obviously, I calculated based on the spreadsheet that I received, and these are not the numbers that are really confirmed, but I wanted to present. Typically, this IEP students are about 13% of ADN, so I need to go back and calculate again, but to give you just historical average, about 13% of ADN. But it is limited to 11% of ADN without waiver. So you get the waiver, you can go beyond 11%. When I looked at the spreadsheet, I found 42 districts below 11%, or at 11%, and 150 districts above 11%. Altogether, I saw 11.8%. Of course, it's slightly below historical norm. I have to go back and check this number again. Waivers above 5,000 students, I think this is about right.
So you're talking about going back to recalculate?
Yes.
When you do that, you might also calculate what percentage of the students are in districts above 11% and what percentage of the students are in districts below 11%. Depending upon which districts are in which number, those could be very different than what they show this here, just counting districts.
Well, then, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In talking with Hillsborough School District, they asked for some relief on this. An interesting dynamic that I hadn't appreciated is that school districts that have IEP students and do a good job with them get a reputation for that, and parents actually actively move into those school districts. They become essentially then a victim of their own success, of doing what they're supposed to do with the extra allocated dollars, and that's educate those special needs kids. And so they were asking for to raise the limit on 11% for those districts that are actually, you know, doing a good job, and the numbers are reflecting an increase in proportion of enrollment in their districts.
Thank you.
About ESL students, 134 districts report ESL students, and ESL students are about 10% of ABM. This is the based on 2009-10 wage data, I recalibrated these numbers. So IEP students about 60,000, ESL students about 53,000, students in poverty about 80,000. And there are other at-risk students. The student cost weights, again, we mentioned kindergarten getting half weight. Elementary only school district students get 0.9. Union High School District students get 1.2. And remote small elementary schools and small high schools have varying weights. Small high school qualification, school in a district under 8,500 ADMW, and if ADM is less than 354, four grades, or ADM less than 267 for three grades. Location should not have changed since 1995 and should have existed as small high school in 1999. Remote small elementary school qualification should be remote small elementary school qualification. ADM below 224 for 8 grades. By the way, ADM limit varies with number of grades. Now, additional student weights, actually, if you look at this 8th grade elementary school. Obviously, 224 is the threshold, so there's no additional weight for school with 8th grade elementary school we're talking about. But then if that elementary school has 125 students, additional weight would be about 55. That's how you read this curves. So 4 grade high school here, if there are 250 students ADM, then additional weight will be a little over 70. So the horizontal axis shows ADM, and additional ADM weight on the vertical axis.
I think what Dave is trying to present here is that the small school correction works on a sliding scale. And so that essentially we have a minimum and a maximum, and at the exact midpoint, after the school district, after ADM exceeds that midpoint, the correction starts to go down. And so that as the ADM, the idea being, of course, that the ADM is not sufficient in order to drive adequate funding for the building and a teacher. As we approach that 350, as in the high school situation, the ADM, the correction eventually just goes away altogether. But the midpoint is the most amount of weighting that the school district would receive.
So this shows ADM R, which stands for ADM resident, ADM W extended, and teacher experience adjustment is 25 times the difference between district average experience and state average experience. So for example, if district has teacher average experience of 14.6, and state average, I think 12.6 is 0910.
Yes.
So then this district would get $50 more per student. So to sum up, equalization formula works this way. State revenue plus local revenue, that becomes total resources available. That is distributed.
Before we go on, when is that adjustment, teacher experience adjustment, when is it calculated? I mean, you don't know what it is at the beginning of the school year, do you?
Co-Chair Barnhart, we start out, we use the previous year's teacher experience factor when we're doing that calculation, and then as that data becomes available, then we roll that into the state school fund, and we use that for the reconciliation purposes. So I'll use 09-10 as an example. We start off using actually 07-08, and then eventually we receive the 08-09 data, and then we'll be reconciling this May for the 09-10 using the actual teacher experience factor on statewide average, and then subtracting that out in May of 2012.
This is part of the infamous toting up that happens almost a year after the end of the school year.
Chair Barnhart, yes, that's correct.
Yep, thank you. Yes, Representative Kelsey.
In my time on the school board, we had the opportunity to end up on both ends of that. It is very fun to learn that your teacher experience has changed such that you were getting more money than you had budgeted to spend in the year that's now over and in which you paid all your bills. It's not nearly as fun to find out that your teacher experience has adjusted and you have completed your school year and, in fact, have much less money than what you expected. That is a glitch in this very complicated school funding system that makes it very hard for local districts to manage their finances.
And, of course, that's precisely why I asked the question.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, please.
Thank you. To sum up, the equalization formula, state revenue and local revenue combined becomes total resources available, is distributed as general purpose grant, transportation grant, and high-cost disability grant, and facility grant. By the way, 2009-10 school year, general purpose grant was about 95%, and the transportation grant was a little over 4%. Education Service District, they get 4.75% of state school funds. We have a funny number here, but basically what it says is education school districts will get 4.75% of total resources available. I happen to use just state school fund right there, but total resources available. So ESD allocation, starting in 2006 and 2007, the ESD share money is distributed as follows. You calculate the based on component school districts share of state funding, you calculate the ESD share and distribute the money. And if that money becomes below $1 million, then you're entitled to a million. So the minimum ESD money for an ESD is 1 million. So that's what it says here. 1 million. You're entitled to 1 million. And over. Or over. Now, this is, resources, of course, it depends on property taxes. Being property tax stable, being stable, you see local revenue continuing to increase and state portion fluctuating. Now, I would like to leave enough time for Brian Wheeler, Assistant Superintendent from Education Department, so that he can actually touch on rich statistics. And also, I asked him to touch on the budget issues. At this point, I would like to ask you if you have any questions.
Let's go on.
All right. Thank you.
Morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent for Analysis and Reporting at the Department of Ed. This presentation I have this morning is a version of the one I presented to the Education Subcommittee for Ways and Means last week. It touches on quite a few of the same things that Day spoke about this morning. So some of them I'll go through very quickly. Some of them I'll go a little more into depth than Day did. And then we'll look at a little more data. Most of the data I have here is for 08-09 actual data from school district and ESD audits. And in certain cases, we have made forecasts out through the 11-13 biennium based on preliminary data for the 09-11 biennium and then based on the governor's proposed budget for 11-13. Really want to talk about four things. Before I get into the formula, I'm going to take a slightly broader look at the revenues available to school districts, that portion of the revenues beyond what they get through the formula. About 80% of the dollars, operating dollars, that school districts get are through the formula. The other 20% come from primarily from grants, federal and state grants, as well as fees that school districts charge, primarily for school lunches and for extracurricular activities such as sports. So here's a history dating back to 1990-91. That obviously is a watershed event in Oregon's funding of schools. That was when Measure 5 passed, cut local property taxes for all local governments, but cut them more dramatically for schools than it did for other types of local governments. So you can see the shift. Local revenue declined rather rapidly through 05-06. That was the phase-in period for Measure 5. Started back up again, and then we had Measure 47 pass, which was then replaced by Measure 50. So we had another dip down in 97-98 as Measure 47, or excuse me, Measure 50 cut property taxes. And then local revenue has grown rather steadily but fairly slowly because of the 3% growth limit that was part of Measure 50. Federal revenue up through about 2001 grew steadily but slowly. At that period, federal revenue was 7-8% of total operating revenue available to school districts in Oregon. With NCLB, federal revenue started growing a little more rapidly. And then you'll see starting in 07-08, that blip up is the stimulus dollars that have been made available to states. And then finally, state revenue, you can see the very rapid growth starting in 1991. That's the replacement with state general fund dollars of the loss in property taxes that resulted from Measure 5. And then starting in the early 2000s, that revenue stream from the state has become very volatile. The recession in 2002-03, and then again the recession that began in 2007-08.
Now, these are unadjusted.
These are not adjusted for inflation.
or anything else.
That's right. These are raw dollars.
Right.
Right. And we'll get to some other measures
Thank
here
you.
Soon.
Yeah.
So here we are at 08-09. Federal dollars, about 12% of the total. I believe Representative Comp misspoke when she said 18. Federal revenue has never been that high. We're at about 12, and this is about as high as it's ever been. And partly because federal stimulus dollars are in that 12%. Local at 34, state at 54. You can see the dollars on the right-hand side add up to about $5.7 billion in that, and that's a single school year. And those are total operating revenues. Very quickly, look at the three major components. Federal is primarily grants that come through the Department of Education, which are then passed through to school districts and ESDs, federal forest fees, and then the federal government does make some direct grants to school districts that don't come through the Department of Education. Local revenue, primarily property taxes, and the second largest is charges and fees. Again, that's fees for mostly athletics and school lunches. Private donations are about 1%, and then revenue from other local governments, which are primarily, for example, a city government may assist a school district by either giving them money or paying for improvements to a school playground, which is also used as a city park, those types of things. And the state portion, 93%, is from the state school fund. 2% from the Common School Fund, 1% from state-managed timberlands, and then 4% from state grants that don't flow through the funding formula. I think they touched on all of these points here, so I won't say anything about these, except perhaps for the last one, that neither the formula nor ODE prescribes how districts or ESDs spend their formula revenue. Those are strictly local decisions. As I said, 80% of all district operating revenue comes to them through the formula, the remaining 20% from federal grants and fees and charges. And I'll touch on this a little more. We have three major sources of revenue to schools, state, local, and federal. But when we get to the formula, we divide those into just two pots of money, one that we call the state school fund and the other that we call local. Well, that local revenue also includes some money that originated in the federal government, like the federal forest fees, and some that originated with state government, the state timber revenue. So they're local. I put them in quotes here because it's not all truly local revenue at its origins. So you can see the breakdown here, dominated by local property taxes. And once you get to the formula, that 80%, two-thirds of it from state sources and one-third from the local sources. And here's a history of, similar to the one I showed you earlier. The one earlier was all operating revenue. This is just formula revenue, very similar pattern. This just goes up through 08-09. If we forecasted that into the future, you would see that state school fund piece start to drop again and the local one to continue to grow slowly. Major point that a lot of folks don't understand is that all of the money goes into a single pot, in essence, and then we divide that up. We distribute it out to districts and ESDs. Even though the local portion is already in district hands, the formula is in effect distributing those dollars as well. And this is a graph that I think demonstrates this very nicely. On a per weighted student basis, every district gets roughly the same amount of money. But the shares that come from local revenue and state revenue vary tremendously. So the white portion on the bottom is local revenue. The red portion on the top is state revenue. So a district with very low local revenue, the left-hand end of this graph, gets a lot of state revenue. On the other end, districts with very high local revenue get very little state money. The end result is everybody in total gets about the same amount per weighted student. And if you see, look on the far right-hand end, there's a couple districts that have so much local revenue that they get no state revenue at all. The reason these vary a little bit is because of the teacher experience factor that enters into the formula here. So here's the weights that Day already showed you, so nothing new here. ADMW is calculated as ADM plus the additional weights, and then extended is the greater of the current year versus the prior year.
Representative Gelser.
I didn't jump in fast enough. Could you go back to the district allocations number?
That one?
Yes, thank you. So just to clarify, even though every district is getting roughly the same amount from combined resources for each weighted student, a weighted student is different than an actual student.
Absolutely.
So in a weighted student, one weighted student in one district might be interested in equal to 23 students in another district.
That's correct. If you look at these dollars on an actual student basis, they vary from anywhere around $9,000 up to, in some of our smallest districts that get the small school, additional small school dollars, well over $100,000.
And follow up, Mr.
Chair? Please.
I think it would be interesting just for this discussion of equity, two graphs that would be interesting to see would be that same graph based on an actual student, a physical student. And the other one that would be interesting to see would be what a district is getting to spend per student in their district compared to what that district is contributing per student in education revenue.
Per actual student?
Per actual student.
Yeah, we certainly can provide that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just to build on that. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to build on that formula, it would also help if we had something that would show us either the school lunch program participation or something to give us a glimpse of the where the county or city fits on the poverty scale.
And Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
I think that would be really interesting. I had, and I forwarded to everyone just a minute ago, Mr. Reeder had provided to me some spreadsheets that demonstrated the number of students in districts, what was contributed in local revenue and state revenue. And I went back to kind of look at the poverty statistics in some of those very, very small districts. And I had assumed that all of those districts would have very high poverty levels. And in fact, some of them did not, and that the property values were quite high and the average income in some of these areas was quite high compared to the average income in other parts of the state. So it would be really useful to see that broken out.
Sure.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
This will be a really long chart, but the it would be the actual number is of great interest, because indeed 100,000 per student, but if you have two students, then we need some perspective of how many dollars could be saved by engaging in what Representative Gelser has suggested, the consolidation exercise. And so consolidating to save and then amounts so saved would be of great interest.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
A quick comment. I think what we're hearing is the discussion that takes place every time we start talking about changing the formula. Please, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And I'm a very realistic person. I know this bill is never going to make it to the revenue committee. But I think a piece of that, just to be clear and fair to this bill that everybody loves so much, it doesn't actually talk about saving money by consolidation. It does talk about local districts contributing to the expense of choosing to structure education in that way. It is not a forced consolidation bill. So it would be useful to see in those districts where maybe you have two students and $100,000 per student, what is that? And I think some of that is available in the Timber County study that we did. What is that capacity that is left available in that local property tax base? Is it maxed out, or is there still room to maneuver where these communities could contribute more towards their own operations?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser, that data is readily available from the Department of Revenue, and we've actually done some similar kind of looks at other districts to see how much room there is. Another point related to Representative Bent's comment, what we'll find, those districts that are spending very large amounts per student, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $120,000, those are districts with two, three, five students in the entire district. So even though those dollar amounts are very, very large on a per-student basis, the amount of savings available from reducing that are rather small in the overall scheme of things. And just to put that in perspective. So
again, another comment on the formula discussion. Please, yeah.
Just some relative numbers here. Average daily membership, which is a count of the average number of students enrolled in Oregon schools during a year. So it's not a head count on a particular day. It's an average number throughout the year, 534,000. That has the kindergartners in there at a half weight. So, you know, it's really roughly 20,000 more if you're talking about actual kids. Once you put the weights in, it brings us up to about 556,000. And then if you look at the higher of the current year and the prior year, you get us up to 662,000.
Oh, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. For average daily membership, is that students enrolled or students showing up?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Air Brewer, it's students enrolled.
Students enrolled. And then is there verification of enrolled students, and are students potentially being counted more than once in more than one school district?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Air Brewer, no. Our data collection system is a student-level system, so it flags any students that show up in more than one district. And then we reconcile those. We make sure that a student is not enrolled in more than one district. In fact, the law says a student cannot be enrolled in more than one school at any given time.
Just one follow-up then. So in our formula, and I don't necessarily think that there's a problem as much as I'm just curious. So in our formula and getting at the ADM, there is no financial incentive in this formula for districts to encourage attendance. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. We don't reward attendance. We don't pay for attendance. We pay for enrollment. So if a student is absent on a particular day, the school doesn't receive less money because of that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelson.
Just to follow up, but if a student is absent or gone for more than 2 weeks, they are then disenrolled from that district.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser, that's correct. The law says that if a student, if a district knows that a student has left the district, they must unenroll them the following day from when they receive that information. If a student is gone for 10 days in a row and the district doesn't know where the student is, whether they've are just absent or whether they have moved on, then they must unenroll the student and stop receiving funding. A little bit more detail on the equation that Day showed you on how we calculate the general purpose grant. Again, the number of weighted students times 4,500 plus the teacher experience adjustment, and then we use this ratio, the balance ratio, to make sure we distribute all the money. So, for example, if you run the first part in there with the ratio at 1 and you haven't distributed all the money available, then you raise that ratio until you do distribute all the money. And then here's a history of the ratios that we've had over the last 8 or 9 years, I guess maybe 10 years there. And you can see the effects of the recessions in these ratios. 02-03, the ratio goes down because we had less money to distribute. 03-04, it goes back up, and it goes back up rather sharply, and the reason is the legislature front-loaded the funding in the 03-05 biennium in anticipation of a passage of a temporary income tax increase. As you know, it didn't pass, so the ratio went back down in 04-05. As we came out of that recession, the ratio grew, and then in 08-09 back down again because of lower revenue due to the recession, and then was flat in 09-10, and then back down again in 10-11 as we made the allotment reductions due to lower revenue than was initially forecast. So over time, in stable times, as the appropriation to the state school fund goes up to deal with both inflation and enrollment growth, you would expect this ratio to climb. But again, the fact that the ratio jumps around demonstrates the volatility of state revenue due to economic conditions.
And the only adjustment in this number is, I guess teacher experience is a very small adjustment, but the only real adjustment in this number is ADMW, isn't it? The number that you get when you calculate ADMW.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. So the ADMW takes account of enrollment growth. The ratio takes account of dollar growth that would be due primarily to inflation or higher appropriations.
It changes in appropriation.
Changes in appropriation
amount.
If you think about it.
My point, I think, was that these numbers are actually not adjusted for inflation. They are adjusted for population changes, but not for inflation.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. The parts of the formula that distribute money on other than a per ADMW basis are the ones that they already talked about, so I won't talk about those again. And probably you know these things already. The cost drivers in education, students with special needs, special education, English language learners, students in poverty, and then both salary and benefit growth. And in the benefits, we're talking primarily about the retirement system and health insurance. Those final taxes, which are federal payroll taxes, have been stable. The rates on those have been stable for quite a long time. And just a little history on those cost drivers. Change between 1990-91 and 2009-10, which is a period that we have actual data for most of these items. Total enrollment over that period, that's a 19-year period, up 16% or 0.8% a year. Special ed students growing much faster than that, 2.4% a year. And then limited English proficient students, sort of a mind-boggling 10% a year that they've been growing. And students in poverty growing more than twice as fast as the general student population. Average teacher salaries growing at about 2.6% a year. The PERS employer contribution rate jumped from a little over 9% in 1990-91 to over 14% in 09-10, and as we know, it's up again from there. And then health insurance has grown rather rapidly as well. So here's some inflation-adjusted numbers, inflation-adjusted formula funding per ADMW. Since the implementation of Measure 5, and this is fairly dramatic. If you believe that the weights in our formula are accurate depictions of higher costs of special needs students, what this tells us is that the real resources available to educate students in Oregon have dropped from about 4,000 per weighted student to below 3,000 per weighted student over this period. That's, I think, it's about 2,800 and something in 12-13 if the governor's proposed budget were adopted. More than a 30% decline in the resources available to our schools going through the formula over that period.
Using $90.91?
These are $90.91 okay. Adjusted for, adjusted using an index that takes into account actual labor and health insurance costs in Oregon. It's not the consumer price index, which is, would be a poor measure of inflation in the education sector.
This is the state school fund, or it's the total?
This is the total going through the formula, so the state school fund plus local revenue.
Right. Thank you. Yes, Representative Eric Brewer.
Thank you for that. What would be an interesting comparison, although I know we're tasked with the financial side, but as you're saying, the per student funding has gone down. It would be interesting to see has education improved over the same time period. So are we getting more bang for our buck as well? So do we have an outcome trend going the same direction, equal or above in performance to the dollars going, the trending of the dollars?
And then pick your measure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chair Barnhart, Representative Eric Brewer, typically at the department, since we do statewide assessments, we look at how well districts are doing on those assessments, what we call the OAKS, the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills. And we don't have consistent data back this far, but if you start in the early 2000s, where we do have fairly consistent data, statewide we've shown considerable progress in the percentage of students meeting or exceeding our standards. So at a time where, since the early 2000s, this inflation-adjusted dollar amounts were initially fairly flat and then are expected to decline in the next couple of years, over that period, student achievement has improved. And it has been considerable, even though it's still at levels that we don't find encouraging. At the high school level, barely over 50% of students meeting state standards in math doesn't seem acceptable, but it's considerably up from what it was before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, probably more of a follow-up comment. I only bring that point up to make sure that the guilt value that we attach to an eroding funding per child must be looked at in light of what are we, are we doing better with less dollars? Are we creating efficiencies? For example, as Representative Gelser just said, when we shut the school down last year for special needs students, that we are able for less money to do something better. I'm not saying that we are or aren't doing it as much as when we, just for our guilt factor for declining funding per student. That's the only reason why I bring that up.
The number that you just gave us, impression that you just gave us around the results of OAKS, do you take into account changes in the dropout rate and therefore the fact that you may have a different population you're testing than you did in previous years?
Chair Barnhart, we do, and actually Oregon's dropout rate has been declining as well.
Yes.
But the caution that I always give to people if you're looking at OAKS scores as a measure of student achievement is that it's a pretty narrow measure of what students can do and what we've seen, and it was influenced by NCLB. it became, the OAKS scores became much higher stakes for districts and schools under NCLB than they were before. So I think they focused fairly sharply on improving OAKS scores, and probably to the detriment of electives and other kinds of courses that are not part of NCLB and are not measured by OAKS. So we tend to focus on math and reading, also on science, but to the extent that we ignore other things that are important to families, important to students, help them be more well-rounded students, you know, the percent meeting on the OAKS score may not be, it's, we know it's not a perfect measure of what our students are doing, but it is an objective one, and it's probably the best one we have right now.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to build on that point a little bit. By objective measures of assessment, Oregon students are doing better, and I think that is a tribute, first of all, to our students who are working very hard, to the educators who work tirelessly to do more with less for each of those kids. But we see that improvement in our OAKS assessment scores. We also were just commended with the improvement in our AP test taking in terms of the number of students in each school district that are taking advanced placement exams and in the performance of those students who are taking the advanced placement exams. We are leading the nation in terms of, we are among the leaders in our nation of improving there. But at the same time, what we hear as policymakers or see in our districts are increases in many of the social problems that take place in our schools, challenging behavioral issues, issues with bullying, issues with obesity, issues with child health. And I think all of those get back to those more immeasurable things of what happens when you have a very large class size without the ability to do more appropriate behavioral intervention, more appropriate exercise, to be, whether it's PE or recess. We see that changing the quality of student that comes out of our schools. They may read well, they may write well, but what do we do to make sure that they can participate in a democracy, participate in our communities, and really engage in problem solving for the future? That's what we lose when we just tie it all to exams.
Yeah. Thank you. Go ahead. You've got to the last of your slides, but I'm not sure we've got to the last of your comments.
That was my last slide. I guess one last point regarding this assessment issue is that the other thing that we see in Oregon is that we have the second, and this has been true for a long time, the second highest SAT scores in the country among states where, you know, more than half of their students take the SAT. When you adjust that for demographics, we don't look quite as good, but my point is that the SAT is a very high-stakes test mm-hmm. for students, and our students tend to do fairly well. Mm-hmm. Our OAKS test, for us, from the students' perspective today, is a very low-stakes test. In fact, it's close to a zero-stakes test for students. It's higher stakes for the schools because they get rated, but a student taking the OAKS doesn't influence their graduation, it doesn't influence their grades, it really doesn't influence much at all. We hear anecdotal evidence that a lot of students get together and say, let's see who can get through this the fastest. And, you know, they simply don't take that test seriously. Well, now that it becomes, in the next few years, becomes one of the ways that they can qualify to get their diploma, it suddenly is going to become very high stakes for most students, and I think we're going to see, and we're already starting to see it, a dramatic jump up in test scores. So it'll be a much better measure than it has been in the past, despite it, you know, its inherent flaws.
And Mr. Chair, I agree that will increase the high stakes in terms of access to a diploma, but as someone that spends a lot of time with young children, even in my own house, I would dispute that it's not high stakes to them. I mean, when you spend a lot of time with third and fourth and fifth graders and they have trouble sleeping the night before the test and they're comparing at the end of the day, is my score better than your score? I just barely met or I exceeded. You're talking about little 9 and 10 and 11-year-old kids, and that is really devastating to their psyches sometimes, and I wonder what we are doing to them for the sake of a number that goes to a department somewhere in terms of undermining their confidence and helping them understand what's the most important part of their school day.
Sure. Thank you. I want to thank our presenters today for presenting a topic which is often dry and difficult in a way that actually I think pretty understandable and quite helpful. I also want to commend the members of the committee for sitting through it. Many of us are pretty familiar with these formulas and in various ways and with the import of them. One of the reasons that Representative Berger and I wanted to schedule this kind of a meeting was not necessarily because we anticipate that there are going to be big changes in this session, but because the Revenue Committee is charged with keeping up on this, these formulas to understand what the imports of them are, and in the event that we do get any bills on the topic, we'll be prepared to work on them. If we don't, that is probably fine too. One final comment from me, and this is one that I make all the time, it probably comes from my background as a psychologist, one of the things we learned in psychology school was how to do psychological testing and how to evaluate what the numbers meant, which is not always easy to do. And one of the reasons why I ask about how this chart was adjusted or wasn't adjusted is because you get very, very different impressions based on what adjustments are made on a chart. And I think we learned that in looking at your very last slide. It is very easy for people who are not as careful or people who want to demagogue an issue to pick a chart that supports their position rather than one that actually expresses reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is pretty well expressed, I think, by your last chart. It indicates a very serious problem that the state of Oregon has in our competition worldwide, in our hopes for our own children, in the hopes for the future. And if we're only looking at our own well-being, in our hopes for a prosperous retirement, because retirement, of course, is dependent upon somebody else working and having an economy that actually functions. So regardless of what way you look at the fact that we have removed resources from education, I don't care which way you look at that reality, it's bad for our future, and it's something we need to figure out how to turn around in some way, shape, or form. We're not getting there this biennium. It's a huge frustration for me that we're not. I don't think there's anybody in this chamber for whom it's not a frustration. But I do appreciate the presentation a lot. Any final comments? Thank you so much for sitting through all this morning.
Remember the 9 o'clock.
Remember, tomorrow morning, this committee is not meeting, but we are all going to be here to help organize the joint tax and tax credit committee at 9 o'clock. Have I got that?
That's right.
Okay, great. With that, the Revenue Committee is adjourned.